Frum has actually his recording studio in his house. He's a sound engineer who's done a lot of work in the recording industry. Apparently we didn't get to talk about that, but thank you too so much, and thank all of you for listening to Wednesday Talk Radio and to all our other great programming here on KBO. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Paul Rowan, thanks for listening. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of WAMBA, Friday, January 1st, 2016, at 9 p.m. at the Analog Cafe in Portland. WAMBA is an African-inspired fusion band featuring improvisation with heavy African percussion breaks. The eight-piece band mixes traditional rhythms from Ghana and West Africa with Afrobeat, highlife, funk, and jazz styles. Again, that's WAMBA performing live Friday, January 1st at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid. With each passing year, the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. become more and more necessary to remember. With this in mind, the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Foundation members would like to invite you, your family, and friends to their 31st anniversary and tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 18th, broadcast live from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Highland Christian Center in Portland. As in years past, there will be a variety of local and regional choirs, performers, and entertainers, all paying homage to the work and legacy of Dr. King and our efforts to keep his dream alive. So remember, Monday, January the 18th, at the Highland Christian Center, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and of course, right here on KBOO FM radio.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, the guest is writer Roy Scranton, who talks about his new book, Learning to Die in the Anthropocene. And later in the hour, Raj Patel discusses his book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market, Society, and Redefine Democracy. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features the moving new work of Ta-Nehisi Coates, recorded at a special benefit for KPFA Pacifica. And at 11 o'clock, the Radio Zine presents coverage of the December 16th People's Panel, sponsored by Know Your City and Portland Tenants Unite. It's called Rent Crisis, A People's Perspective. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support this year for KBOO Community Radio. Please consider donating to KBOO in your end-of-year giving. We really, really appreciate it. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO this morning.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. I'm speaking with journalist and author Roy Scranton. His work has been published in Rolling Stone, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Review of Books, and more. He is one of the editors of Fire and Forget, short stories from the Long War. He grew up in Salem, Oregon. His new book is Learning to Die in the Anthropocene. In the book, he draws on his own experiences in Iraq to confront the grim realities of climate change. Roy Scranton, thanks for being on KBOO this morning.
Thanks for having me on, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
As I mentioned, the title of your new book is Learning to Die in the Anthropocene. I guess maybe a starting point would be to tell us what the Anthropocene is.
Right. It's a term that is still sort of making its way. Not everybody knows what it means yet. So the Anthropocene is a term geologists have floated to describe the idea that the Earth has entered a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, right? The geological epochs, eras of the world are things like the Holocene and the Pleistocene and the Eocene and so on. And the Anthropocene is an idea that they posited, that we've entered a new epoch characterized by the advent of the human species as a geological force, right? So it's this idea that the world itself is in a new geological era that can be read in the rocks, or that will be able to be read in the rocks through human influence.
And how did you come to want to put that in the title of your book?
Well, the interesting thing about the Anthropocene is that it serves as a metaphor for climate change, for global climate change. And the way that it works as a metaphor for global climate change is that it's talking about climate change not as an event or as something that will happen in the future, but it really is talking about climate change as a time period in which we live. And that seemed central, in writing the book, working through the situation we're in now. I really wanted to focus on the fact that climate change isn't something that might happen or that we might stop or that there's some question about. But I wanted to focus on the fact that it's the world we live in now. This is a climate change world, and we need to come to terms with that fact.
You write in a compelling manner about your experience as a soldier in Iraq and how you learned to face your own death. Can you talk about that, how you learned to do a daily practice to face death?
Yes, right. So that's where the learning to die comes in. When I was a soldier in Iraq, driving a Humvee around every day, I was profoundly worried, really frightened about getting blown up or attacked by snipers or ambushed, and these things were happening all around me. And I found it hard even to just get through the day-to-day because I was so worried. But at a certain point, I figured out a way to get through that, and that was through turning to this 17th century samurai manual. Basically, it's Zen Buddhism for samurai, the Hagakure by Yamamoto Tsunetomo. And in that book, Tsunetomo advises that the samurai should practice meditation upon inevitable death every day. So imagining being ripped apart by dogs and pierced by arrows and dying of disease, falling from a cliff, committing seppuku at the death of one's master. And Tsunetomo argues that through this kind of meditation, you can learn to be free from the fear of death, right, by confronting it and sort of owning it. And I started to do that every day, every morning before going out on patrol in my Humvee, going out on mission. I would just imagine all the different ways that I could get killed and accept the fact that I was already dead, sort of confront that fact that I was already dead and that it didn't matter. I didn't need to worry about it. What I needed to do was just do my job as best as I could. And I found that profoundly liberating and really helpful for getting through my tour in Iraq. And I think, so how that has to do with the Anthropocene and climate change is that I think that there's a profound potential there in translating that idea of confronting our own individual mortality into how we might deal with this new world we live in, the climate change world, as a society. And the metaphor there, the analogy is that, you know, we need to accept that this civilization is already dead. We need to understand that global fossil-fueled capitalism is no longer sustainable, and we need to let it go. We're not actually going to be able to figure out how to live in this climate change world as long as we keep clinging to this old way of life. And so that's the root idea of learning to die in the Anthropocene, is is accepting individual mortality and then also opening that up to understand that the civilization needs to, we need to learn to let the civilization go.
I found the part of your book where you talk about how to learn to die moving, and as I said, very compelling. It just seems like that is something that can apply to life in general, to how someone lives their life in general, to approach that process, and that it would be of use even without thinking about the Anthropocene.
Well, that's absolutely right. The idea of learning to die, the idea of reflecting on our transience and our limits and our mortality as a fundamental spiritual and philosophical practice, you know, goes back into not just Zen Buddhism, but even the Western philosophical tradition, back through Montaigne and Cicero to Plato and Greek philosophy, over and over again. Spiritual leaders, thinkers, philosophers have told us, if you want to learn to understand your life and come to peace in this world, the first thing you have to do is reflect on your mortality. You know, as Montaigne said, you know, philosophy is the practice of learning to die.
And I had one question about your use of that method when you were in Iraq. Were the other soldiers around you aware of this practice that you were using, or were you quiet about it?
I kept it to myself, pretty much. I think I might have talked to a couple soldiers about it, but a couple friends, you know. But I think by and large, you know, the environment there, the kind of the culture of soldiering in the way I experienced it is one in which you're not really supposed to show weakness. You know, I wasn't supposed to even admit that I was afraid, which, you know, meant that I couldn't admit that I was afraid and that I found a way to work through it.
After you came home from Iraq, you were put on alert to go to New Orleans following Katrina. That also affected how you think about confronting death, I think.
Absolutely. I didn't recognize at the time what a watershed event Hurricane Katrina was. At the time, I was finishing out my military service in Oklahoma. Like you said, my unit was put on alert. We trained for riot control operations. And I watched the hurricane hit the city, hit New Orleans, and devastate the area. And I watched, most importantly, the aftermath, where the government failed to protect the people of New Orleans and really failed to step in and keep those people safe. And it took me a while to really understand what a profound moment that was, and what a profound vision of our future. Right, we look forward into a future which, I mean, like I said before, we're living in it now. We live in a climate change world where we're seeing increasingly unpredictable, strange, catastrophic weather. At the same time as we're facing stresses on, well, that weather puts stresses on infrastructure, which is already under attack from you know, neoliberal sort of anti-government parties and groups. And then there's also this increasing economic inequality and increasing social inequality. So we're facing a system that's in deep crisis, and it's just going to keep getting hit with more and more of these Katrina-like disasters. And what we're probably looking ahead to is just that kind of situation that we saw in New Orleans, where some people are protected and some people are left to die. And that's a profound, that's an enormous challenge and frightening thing to think about and to figure out how to go into that world and how to live in that world ethically.
Maybe that comes back to having you talk some more about this task of applying to the whole culture, to the whole society. I mean, how does that happen? I don't know if I want to say on a mass level, but how does an individual apply that to the world that we live in?
Right. And that's a serious question. On the one hand, you know, what I'm advocating is an individual response, is an individual ethical commitment to reflecting on and interrupting the patterns of reaction and violence that we're always wrapped up in, the patterns of desire and disappointment and worry and fear and reaction to fear and anger, you know, all these things that are always just coursing through us every day, and fed by news and the media, and fed by real disasters happening all around us. And there's a call I'm making. There's an opening I'm offering to interrupt this cycle, interrupt these currents through reflection, through learning to die. But on a bigger social level, I think what it has to mean is creating space, creating institutions, and creating possibilities for this kind of reflection to emerge and to persist, right, through periods of social instability. I realize that may sound sort of abstract, but what I'm saying is that I don't think we're gonna work through the world, the troubles of the problems of living in the Anthropocene, of living with climate change, by just finding the right policy or just like fixing one thing. You know, the possibilities that are there for that are, I think, largely delusional and obstructed by political technologies and individual greed and so on and so on. Where I think we have the potential to work toward a better world is by developing communities and developing institutions, right, that can protect that space of reflection and interruption through a period of instability and into a future where those practices can help create a new set of values. So a different set of values than the ones that we live with now, right? The capitalist consumer culture that fueling our destruction, right? We need a different way of life, but we can't just decide to be different people. Like those values will have to emerge over time. And I think what we can do now is work to help create a space for those ideas, for those values to emerge.
So what would be an example of an institution that would help that?
Well, I think one possibility is more work in sort of traditional democratic institutions at the local level, you know, and working to rebuild a lot of the community networks, sustain community networks and, you know, face-to-face neighborhood groups and, you know, local political organizations, but also on a more, I guess, long-term way, I'm thinking about libraries, public libraries, and I'm also thinking about reinvigorated commitment to the role of the humanities in universities and in public schools and in, you know, schools across the country. There's been a massive turn toward STEM, toward science, math, and technology, and that's all very important. But we need to recommit to the cultural technologies, recommit to thinking, to teaching, and to thinking, and to passing on the human history of reflection and meaning making. You know, going back to our, you know, earliest cultural artifacts, right? We need to recommit to the humanity, that very idea. Those are some things that I mean. And I suppose I also mean non-aligned community groups working, not necessarily within the current political frameworks, but, you know, just connecting people face-to-face to try to find solutions to, you know, local problems.
Yeah, there's a lot I could ask you there. One way we could take the conversation is from reading your book. I know that you have found meaning in sort of classical literature and the kind of things that studying the humanities provide to people, things like Gilgamesh. And I wonder if you could kind of explain why that's so important beyond, say, the samurai manual that you mentioned earlier, why these works of literature are important to how you are learning how to die in the Anthropocene.
Right, and Gilgamesh is a great example. So the Epic of Gilgamesh is, you know, the oldest work of literature on Earth that we have extant. And it tells the story of this ancient king in Uruk, you know, what is today Iraq, and his arrogance and his tyranny. He just does whatever he wants because he's the king. He causes problems for his people, causes problems for him, and eventually the gods intervene and send down or create a sort of buddy slash nemesis named Enkidu, and they fight, then they become friends, and then they go on and they have some adventures and whatnot. And where the story goes, what eventually happens is that Enkidu dies and Gilgamesh has to come to terms with his friend's death and with the idea of death. He goes to the underworld. Gilgamesh goes to the underworld to try to bring Enkidu back and try to figure out how to live forever. But the guy in the underworld, Uta Napishti, tells him, you know, basically, you can't. You don't get to live forever. You have to die at some point. This is what it means to be mortal. And Gilgamesh weeps and throws a fit and then goes back and goes back to his city, goes back to his people, and learns to commit himself to, you know, building something for the future, right? This story is thousands of years old, and it has somehow survived through being copied out by scribes, and it was lost, you know, for centuries and eventually found again not even 200 years ago. And it's this story about learning to die. It's something like, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 thousand years old, and it can still speak to us. And it's an example of how we humans are able to make meaning together over time, right? The way that we can speak to the future and listen to the past, right? And this for me is huge. I mean, this is if being human is worth anything besides, you know, just having a good time while we're here, it has to do with this sense that we can, you know, we can sort of talk through time, we can travel through time through creating these artifacts in language. And to be able, for me now in, you know, 2015, to be able to go back and commune with Gilgamesh and Enkidu in ancient Uruk, ancient Sumeria, that's a tremendous gift. And it's also a tremendous potential, because Gilgamesh, the Epic of Gilgamesh, is just one possible way of living. It's completely different from the way we live now, right? And it's just one. There are, you know, literally thousands of, more than thousands. The richness of human cultural existence is almost infinite in its variety, right? From Taoism to communism to Islam to the Epic of Gilgamesh to ancient Greece to the Inuit to the Nambiquara of Brazil, all over the world, humans have figured out incredible ways of existing in a tremendous variety of environments, right? And we've lost sight of that because the way that we live now, you know, global consumer fossil-fueled capitalism seems to have won. It seems to have taken over the entire world, and it seems to have been able to somehow absorb everything else. But it can't absorb everything else. It's only one particular way of living. And as the world changes around us, we need to change to live in it, to survive in it, to thrive in it. And in order to do that, we're going to need all those other different ways of living, right? We're going to need to draw from them and learn from them and figure out what's useful and what can help us figure out how to live in the Anthropocene.
I'm speaking with Roy Scranton. We're talking about his new book, Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, published by City Lights. This is Kathleen Stevenson. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I wanted to ask about how what you're saying relates to environmental activism, traditional attempts to find ways to lower the emissions. We have countries come to agreements on that kind of thing, or individual activism. Like here in the Northwest, we have a lot of activism to keep coal trains and oil trains from coming through the Northwest. How do you approach that kind of thing in terms of what you're saying in this book?
Right. The problem there, Kathleen, is twofold. On the one hand, we desperately need to reduce emissions and decarbonize, right, the economy. We need to continue doing all those kinds of activism and even more strongly than we have been, because even though we live in a climate change world and I think we're already going to be facing catastrophic warming and catastrophic shocks to the civilization as we know it, and that's a given at this point, there's still a question of whether things are bad or whether the planet becomes fundamentally unlivable for human beings, right? Because if we continue on a business-as-usual track, the carbon dioxide we're emitting, the methane we're emitting, is going to initiate feedback loops, global warming feedbacks that have the potential to make the Earth unlivable for human beings, especially if the methane, there's all this methane frozen in the permafrost and under the ocean. If that methane melts and goes into the atmosphere, right, scientists compare that to, compare the impact of that to something like global thermonuclear war, catastrophic runaway greenhouse warming that could turn the Earth into something like the planet Venus. That's the worst case scenario we're dealing with now. And we still have, you know, we still have a choice whether we want to run that risk or whether we want to just mitigate that damage and only deal with just catastrophic, you know, climate change and sea level rise. And, you know, I want there to be, I think we can all agree that human life in the future, I mean, I'm sure there are people who are extinctionists, but for those of us who aren't extinctionists, right, we need to fight to minimize and mitigate the damage that's already locked in. On the other side, we need to scrap the whole framework we have for doing this, right? Our environmentalist framework, our green thought, has been largely about conservation and minimizing the damages to the environment caused by capitalism and industry. And it's all basically predicated at some level on a distinction between the human world and the natural world that is no longer viable. We can't live in this world if we think we're separate from it anymore. That's part of what's gotten us to this point. You know, whether it's about protecting nature or saving nature or whatever, we have to learn that we're not separate from nature. Humans are nature. And until we learn that, we're going to keep making the same kinds of mistakes that have got us to this point with climate change. So when we talk about what to do about climate change now and environmental activism, right, it's really this double-sided issue where on the one hand, we need to keep doing it more than ever, and with even more urgency. And on the other hand, we need to reexamine its fundamental concepts and how environmentalism is connected into and wrapped up in the way we live now, which is to say capitalism and fossil fueled capitalism, and get past that, find a new way to think about and live in the world.
I know in Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, you do talk some about, say, the People's Climate March, and you participated in that last year, and you have some thoughts on that. What do you think of that kind of activism?
I thought the People's Climate March was a profound disappointment and a real waste of time and energy. I don't think it was well planned tactically in that, you know, as a display of, you know, public support for some kind of climate policy. I don't think it was well organized to affect the UN meeting that it was supposed to affect. But I also think, you know, strategically and in a broader sense, it didn't affect anything. It just sent a signal, right? It sent a signal to the people who have power. And it's up to them whether or not they listen to it or not. Now, I think we need to very, very seriously rethink the politics of activism, because protest politics, as we tend to use them now, and especially when they're organized in this massive way, like the climate march, to the point where there's not even a central message anymore, just because they have to include as many people as possible, and so there's no central message that some people might not agree with or what have you. It doesn't work. It's not effective, and it distracts us from other work that we need to be doing to prepare for social instability, to work towards social justice, and to work to mitigate the climate change effects that we're already living through right now.
So you're saying that the upheavals that we will encounter, given the unstoppable path that we're on, needs to be confronted and dealt with rather than what, I guess is my question.
Rather than business as usual, rather than trusting in the same institutions that have been failing us for 20, 30 years or more. The recent conference in Paris is a great example of our continued failure to address the real problems of climate change. They came up with an agreement that has no force, is completely unenforceable, totally voluntary, and is little more than a show of goodwill. And lots of people were very excited about the results of the climate conference in Paris, because it was at least something, right? But it's something that doesn't do anything. It's something that doesn't help us decrease emissions, that doesn't help us address catastrophic sea level rise, it doesn't keep any ice in Greenland from melting. It's this enormous, enormous effort. Thousands of people go to Paris to make this conference happen, and they negotiate for days and days and days, and it's empty. And the thing is that this is the 21st conference of parties, right, that the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change has had. They've been doing this for more than 20 years, and this is the best we get. We need to let all that go. We need to let all that go and really open ourselves up to radical change.
What happens if we don't learn how to die in the Anthropocene?
The great thing about dying is that it's going to happen anyway, right? There's the old saw that the only two things in life that you can really depend on are death and taxes. Taxes isn't even in the same category. We're all going to die individually. Like, that's just our human condition. And there's nothing we can do about that fact, except come to terms with it. Like, or, you know, we can try to pretend it's not real, or we can forget about it, and we can we can ignore it. But it's going to happen anyway. And our society, I say this in the book, that this civilization is already dead. Global fossil-fueled capitalism is already done. We cannot live this way anymore, fueled by oil and coal with, you know, massive consumption of animal agriculture, driving in cars, like just living the way we do now is not sustainable for the planet, for ourselves, and it's done. And we get to choose. The good thing is we get to choose how to transition out of this dead civilization into a new one. We can choose to try to do that consciously, reflectively, and wisely, or we can just let it go. We can just let it go to hell. That's the decision we face.
You have a chapter called, near the end of Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, called Compulsion of Strife. Seems to be very pertinent now. You write that we receive these constant messages of apprehension and danger and warnings and insistent needling jabs to keep us afraid. If you could talk about that and how, I mean, because some people would say, oh, learning to die, that's the scariest thing. So how do those two ideas connect, that we're constantly bombarded with fear, but yet learning how to die is also very scary?
Right. Well, we are constantly stimulated, right, with these messages of fear and danger, right? I've probably had 20 today already, ISIS and this and that. And that's a condition of the sort of media environment we live in. And it's also a condition of the precarious, endangered world we live in. Fear, danger, change, mortality, these are facts of life that we're going to have to learn to deal with and to learn to make our peace with. This is the thing, is that they're scary. There are scary things in the world. And we can either avoid that fear and try to run away from it and ignore it, or we can confront it and learn to come to terms with the things that make us afraid. Death isn't going away, right? That's still going to be there. It's up to us to decide whether we turn our back on it and pretend it doesn't exist, or whether we learn to make our peace with it and make it part of our life.
Roy Scranton, we're coming to the end of our time for this interview. Do you think there's something that something that we have left out that you would like to mention, and or also anything that you think is important to say as we conclude?
Yeah, I would say one thing, and this sort of goes back to the question you just asked. But sometimes people tell me that, you know, they think what I'm saying is that we should give up, or that I'm saying that there's no solution. I'm saying that we all die means, you know, that there's no reason to live, that life is meaningless. I've been called a nihilist. And I want to say that's profoundly mistaken. What I am saying is that we make our meaning in this world. We do it collectively, together, not always consciously, sometimes, but we do. We make our lives meaningful through certain practices, the Epic of Gilgamesh, right, the Zen Buddhism, and so on and so on. We make our lives meaningful, and we can choose what to integrate into that system of meaning. Recognizing the reality of our situation, recognizing the reality of climate change, recognizing how far gone it is, and how little chance we have of stopping it, and how urgent and important it is that we try to get it somewhat under control and mitigate its worst impact, right? We can integrate that into how we live in the world, how we make our lives meaningful. In order to do that, though, we need to let go of the way we live now. Because the way we live now says technology is going to fix it. We don't have to worry about it. We're not going to die. We just need to find a new pill or a new machine or a new something and keep buying and selling stuff, and it's all going to be fine. It's not all going to be fine. But we can figure out how to make it meaningful if we confront our limits, our transience, if we learn how to die.
I want to thank you very much for talking about this book with us here on KBOO today. Roy Scranton, thanks so much for being with us on KBOO Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Kathleen.
And just to let people know again, I've been speaking with Roy Scranton, the title of his new book, Learning to Die in the Anthropocene. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.
And thanks for joining us on KBOO this morning, KBOO Portland. Coming right up, we listen to an excerpt from the series The Scholar's Circle. It features author Raj Patel discussing his book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market, Society, and Redefine Democracy. Stay tuned for that. Also, 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, and then Flashpoints at 10:15.
I want to go to the motherland, not children.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Over a century ago, Oscar Wilde suggested